Colin Lacey, who hasn't been over here before, and we trust that he will have help from the Lord as he looks into this passage, where chapter 12 and 1 and chapter 13 and verse 6, and we have the shepherd recognized. Then you know that from 6 until 7:15.
Well, as I said on Friday evening, for those who were here, thank you for inviting me to Northern Ireland, my first visit here. And thank you in particular for inviting me when you're looking at Zechariah. I was delighted about that. It's very strange, you know, as I've walked around, because I don't know too many people, one or two I do, from across the water. But as I've walked around, particularly today, people have been looking at me and saying, "Are you all right?" And my reply has been the same every time: "I will be, if the Lord will, by 6 o'clock. So we look to the Lord for his help. I feel, and I say this very sincerely, very humble up here this afternoon with such a weight of experience and knowledge of the scriptures behind me. And for once in my life, I'm going to want more weight on me than I've already got. And so I'll be looking to that weight for support this afternoon to help us through this reading. I'm grateful that it's there and also in front of me as well. We look forward to your contributions. Let's just turn to the passage that is in front of us today, and it's first of all in Zechariah chapter 12 and verse 1. I think the word on Saturday our brother David used was, in relation to our last passage, he used the word shocking, because there were things in that passage that were truly shocking, the way in which they rejected this lovely shepherd. Well, as we come to chapter 12, in a real sense, the atmosphere changes. And I'm glad in that sense that I'm here in Northern Ireland today to read through this passage and to consider this one with you. I hope your hearts and emotions warm to it as we look at it together. The burden, verse 1, of the word of the Lord for Israel, saith the Lord, which stretcheth forth the heavens, and layeth the foundation of the earth, and formeth the spirit of man within him. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all the people round about, when they shall be in the siege both against Judah and against Jerusalem. And in that day will I make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. All that burden themselves with it shall be cut in pieces, though all the people of the earth be gathered together against it. In that day, saith the Lord, I will smite every horse with astonishment, and his rider with madness. And I will open mine eyes upon the house of Judah, and will smite every horse of the people with blindness. And the governors of Judah shall say in their heart, the inhabitants of Jerusalem shall be my strength, in the Lord of hosts their God. In that day will I make the governors of Judah like an hearth of fire among the wood, and like a torch of fire in the sheath. And they shall devour all the people round about, on the right hand and on the left. And Jerusalem shall be inhabited again in her own place, even in Jerusalem. The Lord also shall save the tents of Judah first, that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem do not magnify themselves against Judah. In that day shall the Lord defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and he that is feeble among them at that day shall be as David, and the house of David shall be as God, as the angel of the Lord before them. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. And I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplication. And they shall look upon me, whom they have pierced. And they shall mourn for him as one mourneth for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him as one that is in bitterness for his firstborn. In that day shall there be a great mourning in Jerusalem, as the mourning of Hadad-Rimmon in the valley of Megiddo. And the land shall mourn, every family apart, the family of the house of David apart, and their wives apart, the family of the house of Nathan apart, and their wives apart, the family of the house of Levi apart, and their wives apart, the family of Shimei apart, and their wives apart, and all the families that remain, every family apart, and their wives apart. In that day, there shall be a fountain opened to the house of David, and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, for sin and uncleanness. And it shall come to pass in that day, saith the Lord of hosts, that I will cut off the names of the idols out of the land, and they shall no more be remembered. And also I will cause the prophets and the unclean spirit to pass out of the land. And it shall come to pass that when any shall yet prophesy, then his father and his mother that begat him shall say unto him, Thou shalt not live, for thou speakest lies in the name of the Lord. And his father and his mother that begat him shall thrust him through when he prophesieth. And it shall come to pass in that day that the prophet shall be ashamed every one of his vision when he hath prophesied. Neither shall they wear a rough garment to deceive. But he shall say, I am no prophet, I am an husbandman, for man taught me to keep cattle from my youth. And one shall say unto him, What are these wounds in thine hands? Then he shall answer, Those with which I was wounded in the house of my friend. And God, we know, will add his own blessing to the reading of his word. Now, I'm not going to go in great detail through that passage just now. I'm going to leave that for the reading. Just a very broad sweep. You may agree with me this afternoon, not quite this evening yet, you might agree with me that there are some stark and chilling truths stated here for the nations that oppress Israel and for the false prophets of Israel. Just look at those stark, chilling statements. Verse 2, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all the people round about. Verse 3, I will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all the people. Listen to the warning. All that burden themselves with it shall be cut to pieces. Look at verse 4. I will smite every horse with astonishment and his rider with madness. Look at verse 6. I will make the governors of Judah like an harp of fire among the wood, like a torch of fire in the sheath. They shall devour all the people round about. Look at verse 9. I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. Look at chapter 13, verse 3. His father and mother that begat him, that is the false prophet, shall thrust him through when he prophesied. makes you glad, doesn't it? That you belong to the Lord. Makes you glad that you're on the Lord's side. The outlook for such nations and the outlook for such individuals, bleak indeed. And it's very easy, isn't it, to look at these prophetic books and to allow yourself to become dominated by the gloominess, by the darkness, by the judgment. But I do just want to remind our hearts this afternoon that judgment is God's strange work. It's his unusual work. And judgment must come and judgment must fall. And this afternoon in our reading, we will not escape that. We will be looking at those verses and others that I have read. Those stark, chilling truths of judgment and darkness. But I just want to excite you this afternoon, along with me, that shining through the darkness and the gloom, we read some sublime statements concerning Israel, concerning the house of Judah. Look at verse 4. I will open mine eyes upon the house of Judah. Look at verse 6. Jerusalem shall be inhabited again in her own place, even in Jerusalem. Look at verse 8. In that day shall the Lord defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Look at verse 10. I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and supplication. Look at verse 10. And they shall look upon me, whom they pierced. Look at chapter 13 and verse 1. In that day there shall be a fountain open to the house of David and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and uncleanness. I just want to say these things for the benefit of younger folks with us today. If there were ever any doubts in our minds that there is a future for Israel, that there is a future restoration for Israel, these verses would dispel them. Read them and reread them. I want to say in a broad thrust this afternoon that we say confidently but reverently that God must and will restore Israel. We say this, number one, because he's promised to do it, hasn't he, in his word. And that word cannot be broken. Broad sweep. He promised it to Abraham. In thee, he says, shall all the families of the earth be blessed. All the land that thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever. Unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates. Now we may be able to say that those words have been partially fulfilled at particular times in Israel's history, but they've yet to be fulfilled in their totality. Thy seed forever. What a future. He spoke through Jeremiah. You read these words? Chapter 31, verse 37. Thus saith Jehovah, if heaven can be measured and the foundation of the earth searched out beneath, I will also cast off all the seed of Israel for all that they have done, saith Jehovah. Praise God, he will never do that. He can never do that. He's promised in his word that he never will. If you can measure heaven, if you can measure the foundation of the earth stretched out beneath, says God, I will also cast off all the seed of Israel. And you might say they deserve it for all that they have done. Yet shining through it all is God's wondrous grace and God's wondrous mercy. He spoke through Jeremiah. Paul made it clear that not even Israel's rebellion in breaking God's law can annul the unconditional promises of God. It rests on promise. For he says in the Galatians, if the inheritance be of the law, it is no more promise. But God gave it to Abraham by promise, and God cannot and will not break that promise. God cannot and will not deny his word. His promise in his word. In spite of all that they have done, he's promised restoration, a future for Israel. And so says Paul as he writes to the Romans, and maybe this will come up in our reading, and so all Israel shall be saved as it is written. There shall come out of Zion the deliverer, and shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob, for this is my covenant unto them, when I shall take away their sins. A future for Israel. God has promised it in his word. Let me say this as I draw to conclusion. A future for Israel because they're inseparably bound up with Christ. They're inseparably bound up with the shepherd and his sacrifice. Can I remind you of the words of Caiaphas the high priest, albeit in unbelief? He says, one man should die for the nation. John adds, doesn't he? And this he spake, not of himself, but being high priest that year, he promised that Jesus should die for that nation. There must be a future. For they're linked with that man. One day, we're going to see today, Zechariah chapter 12 verse 10, they will look upon him whom they have pierced. They're inseparably linked with him. One day, we'll see it today, they'll cry with all its meaning, and we use it today. We apply it today. They will use it in all its fullness. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. At long last, the shepherd is recognized. No wonder Zechariah pens those lovely words. Look at verse 1 of chapter 13. In that day, there shall be a fountain opened. And we'll have some interesting comments about that. As to what the cleansing refers to there. But I leave it just there now. In that day, there shall be a fountain opened for sin and uncleanness. I'm glad, aren't you, that we're a people with a future. And I'm glad we've a future. God says it in his word. I'm glad we have a future because I'm inseparably linked with Christ. Israel has a future. Future regathering, future restoration. God has promised it in his word. And they too are inseparably linked with the shepherd of God's flock. They shall look upon him whom they pierced. How can this all come about? Can I just remind you of the opening of our reading this afternoon, which our brother David led us through? You remember in that verse we heard these words, "And they shall be as though I had not cast them off." And I just commented on that phrase, "For I am the Lord their God." They're inseparably linked with God. How lovely to observe that all this will happen as a result of their link with God and the sovereignty of God. If they were treated as they deserve, like you and me, they'd be lost without hope, without trace. But it's the sovereignty of God that puts you and me where we are today. And it's the sovereignty of God that will put Israel where it will be yet, in a day to come. And I hope you therefore will allow me to lead you through this reading this afternoon by just dividing this section around the sovereignty of God. Really, the I wills. And we'll just see that it's God that brings about all this beautiful scene. It's God that brings about all this change as far as Israel is concerned. It's God that brings judgment upon the nation. It's all of Him. How lovely to see the grace and mercy that shines through the darkness and gloom and sadness. And there's some sections here that will thrill our souls. Will you notice chapter 12, verse 1? I'll be interested in your comments here. Here's the sovereignty of God in relation to this scene. God's power in creation. Why that? Why is that introduced here? What place does this have? It almost appears out of place. But we see God's power in creation. Come with me to chapter 12, verses 2 to 9. And we see the judgment of the nations. We see God's judgment of the nations. It is God that will judge. And I just want you to look at me with me in that little section there, chapter 12, verses 2 to 9. Verse 2, we'll look at the invasion. Verses 2 to 3, we'll look at the invader. Verses 4 to 9, we'll look at the invaded. But we'll look at it under God's judgment of the nations. Come with me to chapter 12, verses 10 to 14. And we'll look at God's grace to Israel. The light shining through the darkness. God's grace to Israel. Come with me to chapter 13 and verse 1. And I want you to look with me at God's cleansing of Israel by His word. Well, we may have some differences of views there. I'll leave it there at the moment. Come with me to chapter 13, verses 2 to 6. And we've got God's cleansing of the land from idolatry. It's all the sovereignty of God. God will bring this to pass. God is in this thing. And therefore it must and will come to pass. I want you, just though it's future with me, to travel through it and get excited about the certainty of it all. The future of it all. And who knows? These things of which we've been reading may not be too far away. Could be the Lord would return today. I'd be delivered from the Bible reading then. If the Lord returned just now, it could be just now. And it could well be that chains of motion are set afoot. These things not too far distant. Exciting times. For the people of God. Exciting times we'll see for Israel. I'd just like to look at the passage, if I may, with you, helpfully and constructively, positively, under those headings. If ever you thought, can I go back to Saturday? that God hasn't got a people, and God hasn't got a place, and God hasn't got a person that our brother David helpfully brought before us. Those thoughts will be dispelled here. We see his people. We see the place, Jerusalem. We see the person, the one whom they picked. We'll move through this section together, if the Lord will. Thank you.
Helen, can I ask, please, we have been using terms this morning,
or this earlier part of the afternoon. Israel, Judah, Ephraim, Joseph, and some are not quite clear just what exactly we do mean. We have been using the term Israel as descriptive of the northern kingdom, but this would not be so here,
no.
Would it? You have been using the word Israel in a much wider sense, have you?
Mm-hmm. I would think, Brother Jim, I don't know whether you agree with me, that when we come to Israel here, the burden of the word of the Lord for Israel, we're talking about a much wider term. We're talking about something here. It's the only time I think it's used in this section here before we narrow down to the house of Judah, to Jerusalem. I would take it would embrace here Judah, it would embrace Jerusalem, it would embrace those of the northern kingdom who will be associated with Israel, with Judah in that day to come. Would you take it as
yes,
more than that?
I think it is all Israel with Judah, with Jerusalem as the capital.
Yes.
Yes.
So we'll look just in this section, if we may, just for a moment. We don't want to pass over this verse about God's power in creation. Why the section here starts in, it's the burden of the word. We talked about the word burden. We need to feel the weight of it. We need to feel the authority of it. It's the burden of the word of the Lord. Therefore, there must be weight attached to it. This is not the word of Zechariah or the word of any other. This is the word of the Lord. And they need to feel the weight and burden of it as we do for Israel in that widest sense. But then we see this, saith the Lord, which stretcheth forth the heavens, the foundation of the earth, the spirit of man, presented in this verse here. Anybody like to share some thoughts with us on why that appears at this particular stage?
Is it that if God has demonstrated his power in creation, both in the celestial sphere and in the terrestrial sphere, then these other issues are, in one sense, insignificant if he's demonstrated his power like that.
Yes. I think that would be certainly a leading thought here, David, that there are staggering things unfolded in this section. And I think we need to just bear that in mind, that the human mind staggers that these things can possibly be and will possibly come to pass. We can rest assured that they can and that they will, because they rest upon the one who is the creator. And if he is the one with the power to create, then he is the one who has the power to bring these things about. Brother.
You see, a general remark on the entire section, how often we have the phrase in that day.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at this phrase in other prophecies as well, I think it is wise to see it in its context.
Mm-hmm.
Here it has got to do with Daniel's 70th week, particularly tribulation days, leading on to his coming in manifestation. Whereas in other contexts it looks forward to his reign, beyond his coming in manifestation. But here it seems to have got to do with tribulation days in particular.
I think that's right. I think it certainly has to do with the end times in this section here, when he will actually deal with Israel and Gentiles in relation, really, isn't it, to his earthly capital, Jerusalem, and with a view to establishing that earthly kingdom.
Just when you mentioned that, Brother Macy, is that part of the reason for this creation business? God is going to take repossession of his planet. Planet Earth that has been defiled and has been creaky under human iniquity for centuries, God is about to repossess it. Is it more than creation? Which stretched, no. Stretcheth,
mm-hmm.
Which led,
yes.
No, led.
Yes.
Which formed, No, former. I don't think this is Genesis 1 and 2.
No.
It's ongoing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that the whole... Yeah. And formeth man's spirit within him, so that God can oversee what's above us, what's beneath us, and what's within us.
Yeah.
The very spirit of man.
Thank you. That's helpful. For those who would want to study these things further and look at the tenses, you'll see that these are in the continuous tense. And we know that we can look back into these things as a past event, but they are continuing. And the continuous creative formation as far as God is concerned. And I think we've helpfully pointed out that the verse would emphasize to us that the Creator does have every right to enter into the affairs of men, because he is the one who created, and he is the one who upholds everything in that continuous way. So he has every right as far as the earth is concerned.
I take entirely, Brother Lacey, what our Brother David Gilliland has said, but there isn't at the same time, and it's just a small point, but nevertheless important. There's not an idea of evolution, nevertheless.
No,
absolutely.
No. Nothing new is being created.
No.
But
there's a 6 days dimension to this, all of this.
Yeah.
But therein, I'm thinking of the Colossians 1, he upholdeth all things by the word of his power.
Yeah.
So that side to it.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. By him all things consist.
Neither Darwinism nor deism.
No.
Deism is distinct from Darwinism, but this is the opposite of deism.
Yeah.
As most of you know what that is, I'll not take up your time to explain it. But you've mentioned the eyes and the I will. The only emphatic I in the whole passage is verse 2. Behold, I. Who is the I? Well, verse 1 has told us.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps we can move that into that second section, unless there's anything anyone wants to say about verse 1. Moving into verses 2 to 9 here. And I think we're going to have to do it in the same way that we've done in the past. And that is to look at sections rather than just individual verses. And just think about the sovereignty of God here in relation to the judgment on the nations. So let's have a look first of all at verses 2 and 3 here, where two interesting things are said about Jerusalem. I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling. I will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone. When everything would appear to be against that city, we see that God has other things in mind. Any thoughts that people would like to share with us on verses 2 and 3?
Could I ask a question about the cup, please? In verse number 2, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all the people round about. Now, would we be right in thinking that primarily in view will be those nations that seem to want Jerusalem?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a cup is something you take and drink.
Yes.
But they don't understand what they're reaching out to take. Is that part of the idea of it?
That's
right. Is that the picture of it?
Yeah. I think it's those nations who are putting out their hands against Jerusalem. And it's like the intoxicating drink. It's a cup of trembling or bewilderment to all the people round about. It's interesting to observe, isn't it, that what the nations are going to experience here, if you look at other scriptures, you see that the nation has experienced themselves. And you'll see those words used in relation to Israel in Isaiah. They've experienced it, but there has been an end to that. Now God brings it in relation to the nations that are seeking to move against them. And they think that they can touch Jerusalem and get away with that. And it's an intoxicating drink to them that eventually destroys them.
So it's not just the usual word for cup.
It's really a basin, isn't it?
Aye, so, as our brother said, you could get one or two mouths round a cup, but you could get a lot of fellas with their mouths round a basin, so there'll be a lot looking to drink of Jerusalem, and they'll all become intoxicated, as you've said.
This is similar, Colin, to Babylon, drunken with the blood of the saints.
Yes.
It's not the same thing, but a similar...
It's a similar kind of thought, isn't it? Yes. But I think we just need to get the picture of the nations, don't we? And you'd have to read around to get a picture of the nations that are moving against Jerusalem in this day.
Isn't there emphasis in these two verses on the word all? If you look at it, it's all the people round about, verse 3. for all people, all that burden themselves,
yes,
all the people that they represent.
Yes. Yes.
Can I ask you, Brother, just in that connection, verse 2, unto all the people, verse 3, for all people, as our brother has mentioned, verse 9, all nations, and I know it's tomorrow's Bible reading, but chapter 14, verse 2, gather all nations. Are those terms all synonymous? Is the gathering of all nations in chapter 14 the same as the gathering of all peoples in verses 2 and 3 here? Is the gathering of all peoples in verses 2 and 3 the same as the gathering of all nations in verse 9?
I would have thought that all people here have particular reference to those that were coming against Jerusalem at this time. I would have thought the all nations would be something that was much broader in its scope.
So are there going to be two attacks on Jerusalem in the future? You mentioned this time. What actually do you think will be the scenario of events? And there's obviously we don't want to anticipate, but tomorrow Brother Mr. Flanagan will point out there'll be something happen at Jerusalem where Jerusalem will be partly destroyed.
Yes.
Obviously here Jerusalem's defended by the Lord supernaturally,
yes,
and it's not destroyed. They seem to be two different events, one with the peoples, one with the nations. If they are, when and where and how and why?
Feel free to clear it up now, David, if you like.
Yes, clear it up for us.
We have a night to think about it.
Do you want to elaborate on that?
I think I'll give the rest of you a night. I'll talk about it tomorrow, all been well. Unless some of the other brethren. I think it's vitally important. All the people round about are not all the nation.
The word is different, David. The word is different. The two words for people in verses 2 and 3 are different words.
Amim and Goim. Yes, verse 3 he says, all the people, though all the nations should be gathered. Now, all the nations will not be gathered in verse 3. But he says, all the people couldn't shift it. And even all the nations were gathered, they still couldn't shift it.
Mm-hmm.
And if all the nations couldn't shift it, well, all the people will never shift it.
Mm-hmm.
So I take it these are two different sieges, but I'm not... Go ahead, I don't want
to... Okay, I would have seen here the picture that we gather from the scriptures around, that when you look at Daniel chapter 11, you see the attack coming from the north. When you look at Daniel 9, you see the attack from the west. Revelation 16 will talk to you about the attack from the east. And so we see all these nations gathering together. So you would see that as later on to what is actually here.
Which of those attacks would you see here, and which of them would you see in chapter 14?
I would think that we would have the attack coming here, where you've got in Daniel chapter 11 the attack from the north and the attack from the south, with the two inveterate enemies of Assyria and Egypt joining together. I would see that in Daniel 11.
But more a Western thing,
yeah,
perhaps
later
chapter
on.
14.
Yeah.
That's fine. That's
okay.
The guarantees that are given to Israel at the beginning of the week, according to Daniel 9, are removed in the middle of the week when the abomination of desolation is set up, thus exposing Israel to the nations around,
mm-hmm,
which is earlier than what we have the Battle of Armageddon,
mm-hmm,
and
which comes later
on in Revelation.
Yeah. Which comes later on.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
But I don't want to.
Right.
You want
right.
to emphasize
yeah, okay.
the burdensome stone.
Okay. So if we look at the cup of trembling, and we've seen these peoples around as we're calling them, and I would certainly see that, as I say, as the first phase with Daniel chapter 11. If we see the cup of trembling, we've talked about that, the basin, and we talked about them drinking from that, becoming intoxicated by it. And then we come to verse 3, and we see that Jerusalem becomes a burdensome stone for those people. And there are various interpretations as to what that burdensome stone might be. Some see that as the stones which young men sought to lift up, to display their strength. Others saw it as jagged, sharp stones that the farmer would pick, would dig out of the ground. However we view that, however we see it, the nature that the peoples around that come against Jerusalem seek to pick up that stone and do what they will with it, but that stone they discover is the stone that cuts them in pieces.
So the verse 3 picture is really an advance on verse 2. A cup of trembling,
it is an advancement,
might intoxicate you, but the other one will actually lacerate you and
that's
injure
right.
you.
Yeah. I think the cup of trembling, the thought has that it makes them powerless, doesn't it? Because that's what drunkenness does, it makes you powerless. And the burdensome stone is something that cuts and wounds them, the peoples and nations of the earth gathered against it. You cannot touch Jerusalem, can you? You cannot touch those people and remain unscathed. So here we see God's judgment of the nations, first of all in verses 2 and 3. We move on and see in verses 4 following, in that day, says the Lord, I will smite the horse with astonishment. Interesting. I asked our brother Jim on Saturday, interesting how cavalry seems to appear here and whether these things are literal or whether we should see them in figure, whether cavalry will play any part. Because God says here, and it seems to read like fact, I will smite every horse with astonishment and rider with madness. Jim, would you like to comment on that?
Well, it's hard to be dogmatic, but I thought that there very, very well might be a return to cavalry. But of course, many will see it just as being symbolic of the powers of the nations.
In verses you've already considered, brother.
The cup, I presume, is symbolic and metaphorical, and the burdensome stone
is metaphorical.
So maybe the horse is, although again I appreciate what our brother Flanagan has said, it may well be, there may be a literal dimension as well, but I'm just thinking so far we're dealing with a fair degree of metaphorical language.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you for that. I think however you look at it, what we discover here is that the enemy is helpless and the enemy is out of control. And it's already been alluded to, isn't it, that while the enemy will be out of control, God is actually in perfect control. And God is directing the battle, and the power of the enemy will be nullified. But isn't it lovely to observe here that I will smite every horse with astonishment, with bewilderment, every rider with madness. Look at the end of the verse, every horse of the people with blindness. But in that day, I will open mine eyes upon the house of Judah. And we see the tenderness and compassion coming through that. As God deals with the enemies, he opens his eyes, upon the house of Judah. Any comments on that section?
I suppose there is something to be said for the possibility of cavalry being reintroduced, because some of these statements you might find very difficult to apply to tanks and other such things, but I say that in passing.
Yes. I was thinking when I came across that phrase of the lovely verse in 1 Peter chapter 3 verse 12, for the eyes of the Lord are over the righteous, and his ears are open unto their prayers. But the face of the Lord is against those that do evil. I think that would just about summarise how he deals with the nations and how he treats the nations, but how he looks at his people. They will be conscious, mine eyes, upon the house of Judah.
Those three things you mentioned, just as you leave it, astonishment, madness and blindness in verse 4, that will afflict the nations. The only other verse where they're together is Deuteronomy 28 and 28
in relation to his people.
So God doesn't have double standards.
No.
Evil in the nations and evil in his people will receive
the same
treatment.
Yeah. But for the one there is a future, for these there is no future. And the governors of Judah shall say in their hearts, So I think here maybe you would agree with me, we're moving in the governors of Judah to the chieftains or the rulers. The governors of Judah shall say in their heart, as they look at Jerusalem, the inhabitants of Jerusalem shall be my strength in the Lord of hosts their God. As they see what God is doing for Jerusalem, as they see how God is defending Jerusalem, how God is protecting Jerusalem, the chieftains of Judah, they will gain tremendous strength and encouragement to go on in relation to that. And they'll say, the inhabitants of Jerusalem, they'll be my strength. But they recognise that that strength that they have is only in the Lord of hosts, their God. Lovely title there, which someone might like to comment on.
So again, it's not strength in their own armies or alliances with other nations, but strength in Jehovah of hosts.
Yes, that's right. There can be no pride in this. And we'll see that even more later on. That it is God that is fighting for them. That it is God that is in control. And it is God that is protecting. Lord of hosts, the title which is used, isn't it, in a day of failure, in a day of weakness. There's a lot that we could say which we won't have time to go into this afternoon. But it's just lovely to observe, isn't it, that they see strength not in themselves, but in the Lord of hosts, their God. Greater is he that is for us than any that is against us.
Bringing in the revelation, won't he slay these armies with the sword of his mouth? Really, it'll be the Lord's power in defense of his people.
Yes. I mean, you mentioned, brother, didn't you, later on in relation to Armageddon and so on, people talk about fights and battles. He will slay them with the sword that proceeds out of his mouth. It's by his word, isn't it?
Just in a general sense, does
verse 5 refer in particular to the remnant rather than to the unbelieving part of the nation, that they would not come in for protection but rather for judgment?
You mean the governors of Judah referring to the remnant, you're talking? The inhabitants.
Yes, the inhabitants. Jerusalem shall be my strength in the Lord of hosts, their God.
Yes.
So that it is the Lord with the remnant, but not with the unbelieving part of the nation, who have already bowed down to the beast worship.
Yeah, I hadn't seen that, but I can see where you're coming from in relation to it. I had seen it much more generally in relation to the inhabitants of Jerusalem in totality rather than the remnant at this stage, but I see where you're coming from. But the great thing, isn't it, in verse 5 is that there is unity when the enemy are in disarray. And that's been brought about by God. Sorry, Dave.
I just want to say, in a very general sense, isn't the existence of Jerusalem a miracle?
Absolutely.
I have a note here, I'll not take up much of your time. It has been sacked by Egyptians, Assyrians, Babylonians, Macedonians, Ptolemies, Seleucids, Romans, Byzantines, Persians, Arabs, Seljuks, Crusaders, Mongols, Mamluks, Turks, British, Jordanians. It has been the stage for 36 wars, has endured over 20 sieges and blockades. Its hills have been levelled, its valleys filled, its temple and buildings burned, its people and priests slain in the streets, sold into slavery and exiled. The entire city has been reduced to rubble 17 times, rebuilt 18 times, has suffered through two periods of desolation and diaspora, and yet it's the major city of world affairs in 2003. Why the interest in Jerusalem? Why is it still? Anything that happens in Jerusalem makes headline news. Is there? Why does it attract the? What about the oil? What about the gold? No trouble knowing why they go to Iraq and so on. I don't think that Jerusalem is particularly famous for those things.
It's the centre of God's rule, isn't it? It's the centre of God's government. It's the place where God has chosen to set his name. Therefore, it must
be attacked, as far as men are concerned.
And of course the assembly presently will have the same type of opposition
to
their brother here.
The preservation of the city of Jerusalem. It is the city of the great king.
Yes.
And we see God miraculously preserving the city for the coming king in his second advent.
Mm-hmm.
We had noticed on Saturday afternoon in chapter 9, God miraculously preserving the city during the conquest of Alexander. That was with view to the coming king in his first advent. We have fulfilled here what God had promised in chapter 2 of this prophecy. He would be unto Jerusalem a wall of fire round about.
Thank you, brother. That sort of just neatly summarizes all that we've been saying in the last few minutes. And then you come down to verse 6, don't you? And you say, you see that God says, in that day again, another expression, in that day, will I make the governors of Judah. And it's just amazing to see this, isn't it? That God is actually giving them credit for what he's actually doing. That I will make the governors of Judah like an hearth of fire among the wood, like a torch of fire in the sheath. They shall devour all the people round about, on the right hand, on the left. And Jerusalem shall be inhabited again in her own place, even in Jerusalem. Would that be, do we think, an indication at the end of that verse of the mention in chapter 14? You wouldn't see that there.
No.
No.
I read the end of verse 6. Jerusalem shall yet dwell in her own place.
Mm-hmm.
So that all these peoples will gather, and the one purpose, as you have mentioned, they'll be like a farmer wanting to lift the big stone out of the field to gain more territory. And when they have done their best, these peoples will be demolished. And marvel of marvels, Jerusalem shall still be sitting exactly where she was, and then there's going to be another escapade, and they'll have another go at it and get even into worse trouble in chapter 14.
Yeah, I just draw attention to the fact that some people have seen at the end of that verse an inference that the city may have been partially destroyed, but you wouldn't see it like that. Any other comments on that? Move over to verse 7 then. We've looked at the invasion, we've looked at the invader, we're in the invaded. Verse 7, the Lord also shall save the tents of Judah first. Lovely to see how God moves in relation to this deliverance, this protection of Jerusalem, that he will never allow pride to come into it. The victory must always be the Lord's. And he saves the tents of Judah first, that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem do not magnify themselves against Judah. So lest pride comes in, God moves in a way that men would regard as back to front. And he saves the tents of Judah first, the outlying defenseless country districts, if you like. He saves them first. Lest the glory of the house of David, the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem, magnify themselves. Anybody like to share any thoughts on what we mean by the glory of the house of David, the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem? In what way might pride come in with them?
I had thought maybe too simplistically it was some sense of prestige at their royal association. We are linked with a royal city, we are linked with a royal house, so we get special treatment, and as you say, the rural districts will, in this case, have precedence over the royal districts.
Yes.
But maybe you have another thought.
No, I have thought really very much along those lines, the natural tendency, if you like, for the line of David to boast in their choice by God, and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, if you like, to glory in their city being the city, as our brother has said, of the great king and his throne. A tendency for them to feel that they were a cut above others, but to bring humility into the scene or to eliminate pride
God moves in relation to the outlying tents of Judah first, before the house of David, the inhabitants of Jerusalem. So he goes on in verse 8 and says that he will defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And we can see that when God defends the inhabitants of Jerusalem, we can see the effect that that has upon the people within it. Verse 8. Anybody like to share any thinking with us on verse 8 about the effect upon the inhabitants?
Is it what we've had before, that they in fact will be made mighty? Those who stumble, those who are feeble, shall in fact be as David. In other words, become mighty.
That's right. Mm. I think that's the thought there. That the thought of the word feeble is the thought of lame. That those who are lame are made strong like the greatest king that they could think of, David. What about the house of David? As God, as the angel of the Lord.
This word God, Colin, I think is the same as the word God in verse 5.
Yes.
The Lord of hosts, their God, which is Elohim.
Elohim.
Which
yes.
is, of course, perhaps harping back to the Creator, the creatorial might of the earlier verse.
Mm-hmm.
And their strength is in the same mighty Elohim.
God in his might and God in his majesty. And they're seen like that. I was interested in the mention of the angel of the Lord. Is that the royal family will lead the nation, as the angel of Jehovah led them in the wilderness? Or is it that they will fight as the angel of the Lord in leading them? I think probably the former.
Could this verse, would this verse
8 be quite conclusive that this cannot be the siege of chapter 14? In that very clearly he's going in this verse, the Lord... he will defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, whereas in chapter 14 the city is taken and half the population goes into captivity.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll be quite conclusive that this must be
before,
and the latter one would seem to be the siege immediately preceding
yes.
Armageddon.
Yeah. Thank you. I think that doubly substantiates that, doesn't it? So we see people feeble becoming as David, and the house of David, so we're talking perhaps about the rulers here, the princely rulers, shall be as God, the royal family leading the nations as the angel of Jehovah had led them in the wilderness. And maybe verse 9 is summarizing for us verses 1 to 8, and it shall come to pass in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem.